And we're looking at verses 27 through to 30. And they're not very comfortable verses. In fact, we might describe them a little as eccentric. I mean, cutting off your hand, gouging out your eye. It's a little odd. And so this morning we're going to try and work out together what it is that Jesus is saying to his listeners, and then what it is that we need to hear through that message. Let me point you first of all to verse 20, which I think is where the roots of what Jesus is saying in 27 and following really lie. Verse 20, I tell you, the words of Jesus, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Their righteousness has to exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees who had these 613 rules and regulations that they were eager to keep and kept. Now, what is Jesus saying? Well, John started a couple of weeks ago was pointing out to us that what Jesus is meaning is not that they must add more laws and keep more laws, but that their righteousness must go deeper. The follower of Jesus Christ, if she or he would be fit for the kingdom of heaven, must have a righteousness, a purity, a holiness that is not skin deep, but begins with the heart and reaches to every part of their life. Righteousness, being fit for the presence of God, has nothing to do with keeping laws. Of itself. Oh yes, as Christians we are to keep the laws of God. But of itself, that is not making us fit for God. It has to start with our hearts. It's concerned with our secret thoughts and motivations. And Jesus wants to explain this to his hearers. And so verses 21 to 26 that we looked at last week with Richard Buse, he starts off and he looks at the sixth commandment. You shall not kill. And he opens that up to the attitudes of our hearts towards our friends, those who are in Christ with us. And then he goes on in verse 27 to the seventh commandment. You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. Now Jesus is not saying that's out of the window. That's very much in our perspective. You shall not commit adultery. It's there on the lips of Jesus. But he wants to take them further. Because the Pharisees say, oh yes, we keep that. We don't commit adultery. Jesus is saying, look, your purity, if you want to follow me, has got to go further. Not only is it wrong to commit adultery in action, but also to commit it in thought. This is what Richard was saying last week about the spirit and not just the letter of the law. Although if we're true about it, we would say that in a sense what Jesus is saying is still the letter of the law. Because the 10th commandment says you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Consider her a possession. Commit adultery with her. And Jesus goes on in verse 28 to explain the full depth of purity and righteousness for his people. And it's difficult to understand. Just let me read it to you and then try and explain what he's saying. Verse 28. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Everyone who looks at a woman, and the word there is general. It's not describing necessarily a wife, but any woman. And therefore I think we can actually broaden it out and say that Jesus is saying to everyone, man or woman, that to look with lust, what does he mean by to look with lust? I think he's talking about looking at someone as an object. As an object. And therefore lust has no part in any relationship, not even a marriage relationship. Looking at a person as an object to be possessed for sexual gratification. Anyone who looks at someone else as an object to be possessed for sexual gratification is committing sin. Let me try and put it another way. Jesus is not here talking about the simple looking at someone and saying, oh, she looks nice, or I quite like him. But when we look and we long and we desire with impure thoughts another person, that, says Jesus, is sin. It is sin to all of us. It is sin in thought, but it is sin. And I think that helps us into the first thing that we can see from what Jesus is saying here, that we have to recognize sin as sin. The devil loves to deceive us. The devil loves to make us think that some things are not sin. Oh yes, committing adultery is sin, but those thoughts you have, well, they're not really sin. And we use our language loosely in the realm of sin. We talk about white lies, as if somehow they're not wrong. We use language about what we do loosely. So when my 3-year-old son is being totally disobedient, he's either being a little rebel or he's actually showing leadership qualities. And then just during the week, I was hearing a leader described as a proud man. A proud man. And that was actually seen as a good quality. Pride was being presented to us as a good quality. And we lap that up and we go along with it. The devil loves to deceive us and to say, all these things are not really sin. Not a bit of it. Some years ago, there was an article in newspaper about a 40-year-old shopkeeper in Leyland, Lancashire, who avoided paying parking fines by registering his car in the name of his 6-year-old son. So when the police came with the summons for non-payment of the fine, it had to go to the registered owner of the car, who by a law from 1963, because he was under 10, could not be guilty of any offence. Very clever indeed. Tempting. But it's sin, isn't it? It's wrong. But how the devil loves to deceive us. Jesus is saying very, very clearly, to harbour impure thoughts in our minds is sin. It is wrong, just as is committing the act of adultery. And that means we need to look. We need to look very deep into ourselves and seek the Spirit of truth, the Spirit of God, to open up our hearts and our minds and say, where is it in my thinking that I am committing sin? What is going on in my mind? Are there impure sexual thoughts that need to be recognized and need to be confessed before God? Yes, I may never have committed adultery in practice, but what about in my mind? We need to recognize sin. Now, we may be tempted, but don't give in. We may be tempted to say, well, why is it sin? Why is thinking like this sin? Surely it doesn't do anyone any harm. No one will ever know about it. It doesn't harm the other person. I think if you think like that, then you're actually failing to see the destructive nature of sin. That sin destroys. It destroys us. It destroys us ultimately. We go on into verses 29 and 30. And I want to look at the second half of each sentence before I go back to the first half. So the second half of verse 29 says this: it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And that's repeated at the end of verse 30. Jesus is talking about the seriousness of our sin. It leads to hell. If we look at verse 6 there, it says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. They shall see God. Now, if purity in heart is seeing God, then the opposite must be true, that impurity of heart means we do not see God, that we cannot see God if the very essence of our being, our hearts and our minds, are controlled by sin and by evil. Purity links us to God. Sin separates us from God. and has the power to ultimately separate us from God, to totally separate us from God, and that is hell. Sin is serious. It can damage your eternal health. And the only antidote to sin is righteousness brought to us by Jesus, imparted to us in the power of the Holy Spirit. But it has to be an inward. It has to start with our hearts and our minds, because those are the things which affect our desires, which affect our actions. We commit adultery in practice because we've thought about it in our hearts and our minds. And if all the time, in our hearts and our minds, we are involved in evil thoughts, and let's broaden it out from adultery, because I don't think Jesus is just talking about adultery here. If all the time we have evil thoughts in our hearts and our minds, can we imagine we're going to grow as the people of God? At the bottom of a garden of a house I used to live in, there was a compost heap. And onto that compost heap, we used to throw all kinds of rubbish, bits of paper, bits of wood, all kinds of bits and pieces. Everything. All the rubbish we had was just dumped there. And with the result that the heap was actually useless. It was useless even as compost for the garden. But if we pour rubbish into our hearts and our minds, the rubbish of evil thoughts and evil desires, it shouldn't surprise us if we become rotten and useless, fit for nothing at all in the purposes of God. I think many of us have been disturbed this week at the reports in the media about that 23-year-old blind and deaf girl who died weighing less than 4 stones. And the house was shown on TV, and it's been shown on TV a number of times. And it looked awful. And as I saw it the first time, I thought, how can anyone live there? If we have sin in our hearts, impurity in our hearts, how can we imagine that the Spirit of truth, the Spirit of God, can actually dwell within us? It's unfit. It's unfit for the dwelling place of God. I believe this is really serious. I believe it's much more serious than we're actually prone to recognize. If there is a fear of a flu epidemic, we scuttle along very quickly to the doctors to get our jabs. Well, the fear of AIDS has set up all kinds of reactions in society. But the fear of eternal separation from God, it doesn't seem to affect us whatsoever. Last Sunday night, Steve Wookie, in his sermon, was very ably pointing out some of the fears that we have, fears of the nuclear holocaust and things like that. And then he pointed us to 2 verses in Luke chapter 12, verses 4 and 5, which read like this: "I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him whom after he is killed has power to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." In Proverbs we read, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord leads to life." But we don't fear hell, we don't fear God, because we fail to recognize the seriousness of sin. And so while we're living with sin in our hearts and in our lives, we sing our songs of gladness and of triumph. But the two do not match up. Can we sing of God's majesty and God's triumph while there is sin in our lives? How can we sing of God in us when there is evil within us? Jesus calls us to see the destructive power of sin, to realize that hell is real, and hell is the final result of sin that goes unrecognized and unbridled in our lives. And then thirdly, because sin is so destructive and so serious, any tendency to sin needs drastic action. It needs radical surgery. And that's what Jesus is saying in the first part of verses 29 and 30. "If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and throw it away. It's better that you lose one of your members than your whole body be thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away. It's better that you lose one of your members than your whole body go into hell. Now, before we all go chopping off our hands over the lunch table, let's just ask what it is that Jesus is saying. He's saying, look, the power of sin is so serious and so destructive that it is actually worth taking any remedy in order to avoid falling into sin. That if you recognize sin as serious, you should be willing to take any step, no matter how drastic, to avoid falling into sin, which is far, far worse. Now, I don't think he's actually encouraging his listeners to literally engage in physical self-mutilation. For to one remove one eye still leaves the other eye. So that's not what he's saying. Very interesting, actually. F.F. Bruce, in his book, The Hard Sayings of Jesus, records that shortly after the publication of William Tyndale's English New Testament, many were trying to prevent it being circulated for fear of what people would understand. And one friar preaching in Cambridge is said to have been so concerned that the simple reader might mistakenly take the language of this verse and I quote, pluck out his eyes, so the whole realm will be full of blind men to the great decay of the nation, the manifest loss of the king's grace, and thus by reading of the Holy Scriptures, the whole realm come into confusion. You see what odd teaching they have at Cambridge. But we need to see sin as powerful and as destructive. And Jesus, seeing it as such, calls, as John Stott in his little book on this passage describes, as ruthless moral self-denial. Jesus is calling for ruthless moral self-denial. If the eyes are the cause of sin, if sin comes to us by what we see, then we need to act as if we have no eyes. Not to watch that film, not to see that play, not to look at that pornographic material. If that's the way sin comes into us, we need to act as if we have no eyes. If sin comes to us through the things we do with our hands, through stealing, then we need to act as if we have no hands. Don't do it. Act as if your hands were cut off. When I was teaching, we had a boy in one of the classes who actually really had a problem with stealing. He used to take almost anything, pens off the teacher's desk, books from other children's desks, all kinds of things. So at the end of one term, on his report, his class teacher wrote, Benjamin has taken things very easily this term. We need to act as if that part of our body through which sin comes to us has been removed. And Jesus is talking with such force to underline the seriousness of the sin that is within us. No measure too drastic. No measure too drastic to be taken in order to maintain our purity. I wonder if we believe that. I wonder if we're willing to take those steps. It seems to me that the real fear for today is not that reading the Bible will produce a generation who pluck out their eyes. But the inability of people to truly read the Bible. And that's produced a generation who are spiritually blind. Blind to the reality of sin and to its destructive capability. What is our perspective on sin and on the sin that is ours? Do we live easily with sin? Have we grown tired with the struggle against our sin? Do we say, I'm never ever going to conquer it, I'll give up and live with it? Do we say, well, my sin is only small, it's not really too bad? That's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying, see sin as serious, see its destructive nature, and then be willing to take any step, no matter how drastic, to avoid falling into sin. Yes, of course, temptation will come. Temptation will come to all of us. I think it was Martin Luther who quaintly put it, we cannot stop the birds flying about our heads, but we can stop them making a nest in our hair. We cannot stop the temptation coming. We can stop the temptation lodging and becoming that impure thought and running the risk of leading on to actions that are wrong. If we would live with God, we must have a purity that is fitting. And Jesus is saying here that the righteousness that is fitting for the kingdom of heaven makes us willing to do anything to remove the sin that is within us. Are we willing? Are we willing to do anything and to do it now? See, I can't spell it out for you anymore because I don't know what is your sin. I know what is mine. I know where my faults and my problems are. I don't know what yours are. But we need to recognize them as sin. We need to recognize the seriousness of sin, and we need to be willing, under the power of God, to actually take any steps to cut out those sins. Now you may say that sounds too hard, much, much too hard. I'm sure the lifelong cigarette smoker who goes to his doctor and is told by the doctor that he's slowly killing himself and must give up, finds giving up cigarettes very, very hard indeed. But if that is the way to life, then he will do all he can to do it. Jesus Christ came, the Son of God, and died the most horrific death so that we might have life, so that God might look at us through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and say, yes, I regard you as just, fit for the kingdom of heaven. And he has sent the Holy Spirit into our hearts. Our hearts become the dwelling place of the very Spirit of God, who is God himself, to make us into the likeness of Jesus Christ, to sanctify us, to make us fit. And Jesus is offering us life, and is anything too great to stop us taking up that offer? When Jesus offers us life, and shows us the way of life, can we say, ah, it's too hard. It's too hard to do that. It's actually cost him life. And when God is giving to us his power, we're not left on our own to follow these commands of Jesus. We're not left on our own to take these things on board. God is pouring his Spirit into us and saying, I will do it. He who calls you is faithful, and he will do it. But I think we have to share the battle together. We have to recognize the sin within us, see its seriousness, and be willing to act to the glory of God and on the path of life.